Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
We are back.
We're back
for installment number two of our crazy series on Dr. Petiot.
So far, this series has gotten like a lot of good vibes.
I know. I love this.
Even from a bad dude like Dr. Satan. But what I mean is like people are pumped for a series.
Which I'm pumped for a series, to be honest.
Yes.
Now, I like this.
This is the series of all series.
It really is.
I mean, you guys got to buckle your seats because... Buckle your seat belts,
thank you.
And stay in your seats.
Yes, ma'am.
Keep arms and hands inside the legs.
Inside the cabin.
Wow. Anyway, people, what I'm going to say is you're in for a ride.
Happy Wednesday.
I can't talk. Happy Wednesday. We are having a, I'm currently on a staycation.
Woohoo.
Which is much needed.
Yes,
I had a little depressing moment yesterday afternoon because when I was doing my out of office, I realized I had not done a previous out of office message since last October.
Oh, that's sad.
And I went,
sad.
That is far too long.
Yeah.
That is far too long.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm enjoying this few long weekend staycation.
You absolutely deserve it because you work so goddamn hard.
It's been a few months.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, it's been way too long.
It's been stressful.
Yeah.
But anywho, we're here. It's a Wednesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Children's are in daycare and at school and we get some mama time.
And we're podcasting because we love you guys.
Hello.
Hello. Why not?
Yeah. So Kate. I mean, so she just told me that this series is going to be how many episodes?
Probably four. a final number is TBD.
Wow.
But as I'm, you know, getting the copy together for the upcoming few episodes, I'm realizing, wow, I haven't even touched on this yet. I haven't even started talking about his like arrest and his trial. And so there's just a lot of layers here between what happens in the, you know, geopolitical climate and the war at the time is very influential on this case and what happened. So there's a lot to unpack.
So that's what I mean when you're in for a ride. So buckle in.
Buckle in.
Because this one is deep.
It really is.
It's deep. But before we do that.
Petillon.
The business.
Yeah, the business. We have Lynn McDonald.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome, Lynn.
We love you, Lynn McDonald. And you're from New Zealand, and we love that for you.
Ooh.
I know.
Oh, gosh. That's wonderful.
She's fancy.
Hello down there.
And then we have Marina Radford. Ooh. Radford.
Hi, Marina.
Hi, Marina. Do you live on a marina?
That's a beautiful name.
I know.
Marina.
Isn't that nice? Okay. You guys are funky. Fresh little gnomes that are just like hopping around in a tree trunk, just living their best lives.
They're gnomes.
Yeah.
I hope they're cute gnomes.
Oh, God. Of course they're cute. Are you serious?
Oh my
of
God.
Course they're cute gnomes. They're not like, no, I didn't mean like gross, like trolly looking gnomes. I meant like cute gnomes.
Adorable
okay?
with the little button nose.
Yeah. And the hats.
So in long-term care where we work, right? Like there's still a lot of COVID crap, and when we're in an outbreak, so we all have to wear our goggles.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody the other day, it was adorable, has a gnome on their desk and they store their goggles on the gnome.
Oh my God, that's
so like
smart.
He's wearing this giant pair of goggles with this little button nose. It was adorable.
That's very cute.
Welcome to
that.
The family, both of you.
Welcome to the family.
You're joining just in time. I think probably what? Maybe around June, we'll be able to do, end of May to June, we'll be able to do a Patreon
giveaway.
Patreon giveaway.
Of some kind, yes.
So, because Kate and I are recording multiple episodes today, and we're only released every 2 weeks, I think this episode now, if you want to be part of the Patreon giveaway, get in there.
Get in there.
Get in there, because it's happening.
And I also have a feeling that these next few installments are going to be available for Patreons exclusively, like, pretty early.
Yes.
And it's going to be awesome. So if you're itching for more,
yes,
Patreonism is where it's at.
Oh,
I know.
I like that.
That's, I made it up. So
Okay.
Without further ado, let's get into pot de.
Pot de.
Yeah. I'm still very much in the French vibes, as you can all, I'm sure, tell. So I'm going to do just, as I usually do, a brief recap, but please, please, please listen to episode one if you haven't already.
It's so detailed.
It is. There's details. There's a
lot. I feel like I'm living in this era.
Yeah. And I hope that you continue with that sentiment. So where we left off, Dr. Petiot had some disturbing behaviors as a child, including but not limited to animal cruelty, hypersexuality, and was very difficult, we will say, with his classmates, and even like made them all very uncomfortable and was kind of unsafe. But he was also very intelligent and extremely manipulative. He was found at around 17 to be, quote, mentally incapable of being held accountable for his actions, like by a court of law. This was like an official ruling. Mm-hmm. Soon after that, he's drafted into the military, where he suffers like some mental health crises, apparently, eventually leading to his discharge from the army. Some years later, he enters this accelerated medical training program for military veterans.
Which is insane.
He completes this in a year.
Insane.
With one internship. And I read that this one internship that I had mentioned was at a psychiatric facility, was in a facility he was hospitalized.
Stop.
I swear.
No.
I swear. So the 180 that happened there was like one of the biggest 180s like in history, I think.
That's a little different. Like, you know, think about when you go back to visit your high school, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you see
yeah.
your old teachers like, wow, look how far you've come.
I know.
I'd imagine in this situation, some of the other doctors are like, are
you look familiar.
Are we sure you are should be sure? here right now in hopefully, this capacity?
Hopefully somebody recognized him and was like, well, now. Yikes.
Yeah.
Not that you can't be a physician and have mental health issues.
Of course.
That happens. But
of course.
His were more than, you know, what was safe at the time because yes. of their limited treatments.
Uh-huh.
So he completes this medical training program. He begins his practice in a small village called Villeneuve, and he's seeing patients. On the surface, he seems lovable and professional and is building this great reputation for himself. But just beneath the surface, he's manipulative, deceitful, dishonest. He takes advantage of people, and we're starting to see that.
And he exploits.
Yes.
Although he said he would not.
He said in his flyer that he would not exploit people, but he is indeed exploiting people. And his girlfriend disappears under suspicious circumstances and is later found dead. The
potentially pregnant one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So he then seeks to become mayor, which he then achieves by undermining his opponent's mm-hmm. campaign. He
sounds typical of a politician, though.
Yeah, very much so. So he gets married to somebody else, obviously, and subsequently a gruesome murder of a respected community member sort of rocks the small town. So that's sort of where we left off. Unfortunately, while it's suspected that he committed this murder that we talked about in part one, it's nothing that they could prove. They didn't have any physical evidence, and they didn't have any fingerprint. The only physical evidence they really had were a set of bloody fingerprints, but they didn't match anybody.
And we left off with letters, right?
Yeah.
Like
and
he
the
was
letters,
taunting the police?
He was taunting the police.
Yes.
Yep. And yeah. publishing these letters in the newspaper that were very, you know, come and get me, motherfuckers. And
wow.
Dead ends all over.
Wow.
Yeah. So here we are.
Go.
Now, trigger warnings. This case does involve grisly murders. We're not getting too heavily into the grisly murders, believe it or not, even yet in this part. But we're going to touch on a few things. There's military themes here. There's Nazism and anti-Semitism themes as well, because if you think about the time period, it's, you know, World War I into World War II that we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
Now, during all of this whole fallout of this murder, Marcel is entangled in this other legal affair. Not quite a murder, not quite as aggressive, but, and it's actually very stupid, but it has pretty significant consequences, and it seems very boring when I talk about it, but I promise there's a point and it's going somewhere. So basically, as there's an investigation about this murder, Petiot was accused of stealing a couple of tins of oil from a local railroad platform. This happened a year prior to the murder even happened, in December 1928. The whole thing, to his credit, was a bit of a mix-up. So he had legitimately ordered and paid for some oil to be delivered to his home. But the delivery guy who was supposed to pick up the oil from the train station and bring it to Petiot's house did not like Petiot. From a political standpoint, they were in different parties. So he left the oil tins sitting at the train station on the platform there and just said, fuck this guy. I'm not going to bring him his oil. He can go die.
Which, I mean, you can't do that.
I mean, no, all, you, sure. You can't. So weeks later, this oil is not coming. It's not coming. So he goes to the platform to pick up the order himself. The station master was not present at the time, but he saw the tins of oil and he just was like, that must be my oil. And mm-hmm. he took it. Not a huge problem since he had technically bought and paid for the oil and it was his technically. But the problem came when he contacted the oil company after all this and demanded a refund stating that he never received the oil. So, this is all really dumb.
Yeah.
And some of it sounds like maybe a mix-up or a misunderstanding. But this ended up going to small claims court, and he was tried and found guilty of fraud. And he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for
Petiot?
This. Petiot, yeah.
Because he had the oil, but claimed that he didn't to get the money back.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He should have just said it wasn't delivered like I ordered.
I know.
Like, then you'd have a case.
Yeah, exactly. But he just, any financial gain, this guy is like on it. And like any opportunity for financial gain.
So for this, he gets sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Yep.
When all of the other stuff that he had previously done, he's too insane to be held competent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he actually go to jail?
No. Stay tuned. Okay. Again, this seems boring, but I promise it's going somewhere. So now he's convicted in February of 1930. As a result, he's stripped of the title of mayor because you can't have that title if you're like literally going to jail. Now
that was short-lived.
I know. So that same month he was convicted, he actually filed an appeal that was approved, which is, you know, that's understandable. This was all kind of absurd. And since the appeal went through, his mayorship or what have you was reinstated. So he was only robbed of that title briefly and he never actually went to jail. Now, this minor legal battle kind of started this whole snowball effect for Marcel. More and more complaints start making it to authorities over these misdeeds and weird things that seem to happen all around him.
All so, business related?
Well, not all of it. Like, so much of it is just minor, but there was just so many events that it was becoming really hard to ignore, even though he was who he was. Like, we know that he's a doctor and he's the mayor of the town, but like, okay, this is all getting really suspicious. So between the legal issue he just overcame, the missing property, like people, you know, he's stealing shit and then selling it from people right. that he doesn't like or donating it. Like, just stupid little stuff. He was suspected to have been embezzling from the town, like we mentioned right. that. And this is all.
Which doesn't surprise me at
all. No, it doesn't at all. This guy, again, any, you know, financial gain he can get, it seems like he's scrambling to get it.
I will not exploit.
Yeah. He doesn't exploit people, Devin.
No.
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 He said so.
Yeah, he said so in the flyer. All of this sort of triggers this formal investigation by officials from the town of Villeneuve, as well as they brought in an independent auditor from a neighboring town. It was actually the town of Auxerre, which is where he grew up. And they reviewed the town's records and they found like several improprieties, like mostly financial stuff, like missing monies, miscalculated deductions, things like that. Based on their findings, the inspectors turned their findings over to the public prosecutor, who was the one that would determine if there was any cause to file criminal charges based on any of this. So the prosecutor conducts their own review and end up uncovering even more tiny issues. Like, this is all, these little misdeeds, like, are fairly minor. Again, he's not making massive amounts of, he's not taking massive amounts of money from the town, only bits here and there so that it doesn't get noticed, but like it snowballs into this massive amount. So it's culminated in the prosecutor sitting down with Petio for a formal questioning. And Petio was immediately hostile, defensive.
I've noticed a lot recently as I, you know, mature. People who know they're in the wrong, deflection is huge.
Huge.
And they put on this facade and it's mind-boggling.
It is.
Because then when you find out behind closed doors, that deflection is just like, wow, wow. I can't, you know, because it seems when they're initially deflecting, like, oh, wow, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And then you find out the details and it's...
And you're like, nope.
Yeah.
And that's that narcissism stuff, too. You know, like we talked about, you know, he's trying to make this prosecutor feel like he's crazy for even raising that concern. And I have an explanation for all of this. Whether it makes sense or not is totally irrelevant. So he's defensive. He's, you know, they're essentially having a big pissing match about the whole thing. He insists that he knows absolutely nothing about any of these errors and that it had nothing to do with him. It's all clerical stuff. It has to do with incompetent staff at the town hall that are all keeping track of this. It has nothing to do with me. I'm the mayor. It's on the flyer.
It's not
I don't
me.
Exploit people.
Did you see my flyer?
Have you seen my flyers? I don't exploit people. He manages to really piss this prosecutor off. Like, over several periods of questioning, this guy's like, this guy is ridiculous. Like, I think the prosecutor's finally, you know, starting to see that, okay, this guy's really trying to just like flip the narrative and I'm not going to buy it.
Right.
So the two kind of go back and forth for a while. The prosecutor would ask more questions after the encounter, and he and Petio would just respond with more defensiveness, more dismissiveness. And ultimately, he started giving these like subtle threats. Like, you know, I'm a really important man, right? Like, if keep coming at me about this, you know, you might not have a job. We don't know. Like, he was starting to sort of make those insinuations. And this was very much the wrong person to do that to. The prosecutor was like, oh,
hold up.
No, nope. So ultimately that August, because of that behavior with authorities, he was once again stripped of his mayoral title because he was under such scrutiny.
Yeah.
And they still hadn't decided if they were going to pursue any action. He's stripped of his mayoral title. So, according to French law, in a town of fewer than 35,000 people, remember this town is
so
tiny.
So small.
Election campaigns must begin immediately for a replacement once somebody is removed from office.
Okay.
So the race begins, and one of the candidates is none other than Marcel Petio. Him being stripped of the title once before in no way legally prevented him from running again, apparently.
Sorry, what?
Yeah.
So this is his seat that's up.
Yep. And he's running again for re-election. Yes. So unfortunately, due to the fact that he literally could not help himself from trying to fuck with his opponent's campaign and try to tilt the vote in his favor, he starts doing shady shit to the campaign. He's just like doing environmental stuff, like trying to make sure that, you know, his opponent can't give speeches.
Is there hype around him running again?
A little bit, because these opposing political parties are still like, again, sort of parallels to today. It doesn't matter how shitty someone is. If they align with your political beliefs, that's my guy. That's him. He still had a lot of supporters, like a shocking amount of supporters. He's messing around with his opponent's campaign, and ultimately his opponent's like, look, this guy's obviously like trying to corrupt the campaign here, and he's doing like fraudulent shit to do it. So the authorities get a hold of this, and he is tried and convicted of corruption. Just corruption. And sentenced to 15 days in jail for that. So, additionally, because of his conviction, he was stripped of the right to hold office.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah. Good.
And therefore, finally removed from the mayoral race in 1933. So that same year, he and his wife decide, we can't stay here. You know, I've been humiliated in this community, and I've tried many times to hold on to my mayoral title, and it's just not happening. They decide to relocate to Paris, for a fresh start. And the two do have a son around this time also. His name is Gerhard.
Ooh.
And so they start out living in this small apartment in Saint-Lazare, which is in Paris. It's a neighborhood in Paris. It's actually a pretty busy commercial district, so there's lots of, you know, foot traffic through there. And it's a great spot for him because he's starting a new practice. So he's like, you know, I gotta like pick a spot that's pretty busy so people will see my signage and what have you. And what does one do when they're starting a practice to advertise?
Flyers.
Yeah.
No way.
He makes more flyers.
He did it again.
I love this so much. I love the flyers.
What's this one say?
He makes these flyers. He boasts on them of a bunch of credentials, real and imaginary. He promises cures for the incurable, painless childbirths, and a host of like other innovative new techniques using surgery and new medications and just super duper inflated stuff. And he has these printed, and he personally goes around and places them in every mailbox that he can find. Hmm. So even though his claims were wild, he did start attracting some clientele, and he's now building his
painless
patient list.
Childbirth sounds amazing.
I mean, can we get this
sign
guy
me up?
Literally sign everyone up. Painless childbirth. Okay. Like, you have my attention. So he's getting these, this clientele. He's building up his list. He starts off again like he did in Villeneuve with like that painstaking devotion. Like, he's working long hours. He's waiving fees initially. Waiving fees. He's making house calls even far away into
building,
the wee hours of the night.
Building the clientele.
Exactly. Building that trust with the community. So it's all showmanship. You know, it's all this showmanship that he has to put on initially so he has that reputation. So following the discovery of his crimes years down the road, some 2,000 of his former patients from this time period were interviewed by authorities just to get like accounts of,
wow,
you know, how was he in this time period?
Mm-hmm.
The vast, vast majority had not a bad thing to say about him. They said he was very well respected, sharp, conscientious, a gifted physician who seemed to know exactly what you were coming in with before you even opened your mouth. Ah, I know exactly
Are
what
we
to
sure?
do for that. That's what they say. That's what they say.
Hmm.
And you know, the guy is really smart. And mm-hmm. maybe from a medical, maybe medically, you know, he was a very academic guy. Maybe he
a savant.
Did. He was exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Somewhat. So it's very possible that he was, you know, really very good at what he did. It's just like, if you could just stick to the medicine and maybe not all the other stuff.
The murders.
The murder.
The arson.
Maybe don't be so murdery about it.
You know?
It was not long, though, before few complaints start to get lodged against him. Again, the vast majority are very pleased with him, but there are a few things kind of floating around about him. There were rumors in the community floating around that he had started performing illegal abortions.
Mm.
Additionally, there were concerns that while he was boasting these curative abilities and using non-narcotics and other methods, that he was actually supplying narcotics in massive quantities to drug addicts and drug dealers and people that were selling it on the streets. And he was actually named in a couple of suspicious death cases wherein he would perform some kind of minor procedure where he would like medicate a patient and either, you know, lance an abscess or, you know, do something like minor. And then later on they would die, you know, because they would just never wake up. And essentially he overdosed them.
Did they have lidocaine back then?
I don't know that they had lidocaine, but they were using a lot of narcotics for sedation.
Wow.
So there was no real proof at that time of foul play, but there were reports starting to come in that like, okay, my mom or my sister didn't do so well after a minor procedure. All of a sudden she's dead. Yeah, exactly. So he's starting to get, you know, that kind of pinned on him. Now, the following year, this is 1936, we're at, he starts getting himself into more trouble. This is another really dumb thing that snowballs into a lot. So he's passing this bookstore on foot, which has this outdoor like books display. And there's a security officer for the few stores on that block who watched him walk by the racks, sort of stop and look, pick up a book, slip it under his arm and walk away. Like, we know that he likes to steal.
Petty theft.
Like, he could easily afford that book. He just likes to take shit that doesn't belong to him. So the security officer saw him do this, though, ran the guy down who, you know, and he said, "Who are you? Produce your identification." And he produces papers, and it was Dr. Marcel Petio. And the way this is described in the book that I mentioned is like kind of comical. He like looks down and he seems shocked and flabbergasted that there's a book under his arm.
What? How'd that get there?
Literally, how'd that get there?
You put it there. You planted it.
And he claimed, "Oh, I must have just grabbed it in a moment of just absent-mindedness. I'm so sorry." And he offers to pay for the book, and he says, I'll just pay for it. And the security officer's like, "Yeah, nope, you're going to come with me. We're going to go to the police station right now." And so he grabs his arm, and a scuffle ensues. And Petio, of course, goes from 0 to 60 in half a second, and he puts his hands around the guy's throat and tries to strangle him.
Stop.
Like, okay, dude, now you're actively trying to murder me. Like, this has become a big deal. The security guard like is able to get Petio off of him, and Petio takes off running like towards the tree line.
He recognized him though, like he knew
who
he was.
He knew exactly who he was. He had seen his identification. So the guy obviously is like, okay, this guy literally tried to steal. I tried to stop him, and then he attempted to murder me. So he goes to the police. He lodges a complaint against him, naming him as Dr. Marcel Petio. The police.
No other witnesses?
There were witnesses. This was in the middle of the street. I mean, a bunch of people saw him. So the police go right to his house and they try to find him. They find him, and Petio immediately reduces into this pathetic pile of sobbing goo.
Oh, come on.
And he begs the officers, "Please don't tell my wife, and I'm suffering from depression, and I've spent time in mental hospitals. Here, I have the paperwork to show you." And he gives them all this paperwork from his prior mental hospital stays. He's even able to produce paperwork from when he was discharged from the army for psychiatric illnesses. And
where's the paperwork that says, "Here, I can't be held responsible for anything I do"?
Exactly. So he's trying to twist it and reach for that again.
Yeah.
And it gets crazy. So the police are immediately concerned about him because he even starts making, he knows exactly what to say. He starts making statements to, "I'm feeling suicidal. I'm going to kill myself." So now the police are like, okay, I mean, we got to, you know, get this guy evaluated medically or psychiatrically to figure out what the heck's going on. He's obviously in some kind of crisis here. The concern was escalated to the police commissioner. The police commissioner was like, "This guy's a physician. We have to first and foremost make sure his patients are safe, you know, and make sure that he is safe." So he orders Petio examined by a psychiatrist. yet again.
Do they put him on like a hold of you can't treat anybody right now?
I don't know because they didn't explicitly say that. I'm hoping they did.
Right.
I would imagine that right. they did. You never know.
In part of making sure that his patients are safe.
Right.
You're not caring for anyone but yourself right now.
Right. I mean, it occurred to him that he wanted to keep his patients safe, so I would assume that he put something in place. This psychiatrist examines Petio and deems him at the time to be a danger to himself and to others. So he orders that Petio be committed to a psychiatric treatment center immediately. Of course, for his assault charges, he presented before a judge and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Again, not my term. So he skates through another criminal charge, but now he's in a psychiatric facility.
Good.
As soon as he was interned in the psychiatric facility, he demands release. He said, "My condition was temporary. I am no longer suicidal. I am totally and perfectly cognizant.
Oh, boy.
And I am completely cured." This was an intermittent issue.
Acute.
This was
not
acute.
Not chronic.
And not chronic. So psychiatrists there evaluate him and found him to be calm, free of delusions, not suicidal, not paranoid, not anything that brought him in. They give him a green light. They clear him.
Ugh.
Hold on. They clear him. And they sent in papers petitioning the courts to allow his release. Fine. Months go by and he's not released.
Good.
Months. The courts will not let him out. So the
Good.
Courts in this situation make the final determination of yes, you can walk or no, you can't. Finally, somebody is looking at all these very nice flashy papers that he provided mm-hmm. them with his medical discharge and all these crimes that he was accused of and then didn't end up getting held accountable because he was having a psychiatric episode.
Uh-huh.
So they all started really being suspicious that he is faking all of that.
Playing it up.
Just to get out of charges. And I think they're right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the guy goes really far with this. He's committed. I will give him that.
He's extreme.
He shot himself in the foot in the military to get out of the military.
Yeah.
The doctors keep writing letters to try to get him released. His wife, Georgette, is also petitioning the courts to get him released. She's writing letters every single day to try to get him out of the mental hospital. And even though he's been medically cleared, he's still being held there. And not only his assault charge, but concerns with his medical practice. I mean, they know that if this guy's released, he's going to go right back to being a doctor.
Yeah.
And this is all just going to go away again.
Uh-huh.
And what kind of risk to the public is that? They also are made aware of these deaths that were a little suspicious. And like, we really need to weigh whether or not this guy's safe to practice medicine. Like, are we sure? Because again, this all goes away once he's gone. And unfortunately, even though they had suspicions, they could not prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was faking the mental state at the time. They had suspicions, but they could not prove that. So at the time, he was finally released in February of 1937 after spending 7 months
in the hospital. I was just going to ask you the total time frame.
Yep. Being in a psychiatric treatment center, and back then, again, psychiatric facilities were not what they are now.
No.
They were real bad. I don't know, you know what, and I don't know about France. Maybe they had a different
right.
system. Hopefully they did.
But we kind of know generally, especially in that time period, and that's actually been something that you and I have talked about as far mm-hmm. as a topic for the
yes.
show of med crimes.
Yes.
Is how bad these psychiatric facilities were back in the 30s and 40s
yes.
and early
and
on.
And the procedures, the
yes.
lobotomies,
yes.
The stuff that happened.
And most of it is due to lack of knowledge and research
well,
at
is.
The time.
And
obviously.
Lack of being able to do anything else for these
but
people.
But still, it just seems criminal with how bad they
oh,
are.
Oh, it definitely is.
Yeah.
And I think we should totally still do an episode like
that. I think
that.
That's coming up.
I think it's coming. Now
I
that we've had
coming.
This episode, it's a coming. Okay?
Yeah.
The next few years go by. Petio continues his medical practice. And he starts doing other shady shit because he can't help himself. So
does he at least take a time period where he's like, I'm on a radar. I need to just...
And be normal. A little bit with some of the stuff. It's felt that around this time, he kind of backed off on the narcotic sales and tried other modalities. So he starts getting involved with tax fraud.
Sure.
So
why not?
Right. Throw it on the pile. I mean, it's a less like harmful to human beings way to try and make money. So what he did was that he was underreporting his income to the government by about 90%.
Oh.
Yeah. He was only reporting like 10% of what he was making and pocketing the rest and not paying the taxes on it. So that he ended up with some legal trouble in, and he was never imprisoned for it, but he did get fined pretty significantly for all of that. And despite all these things happening, despite psychiatry records and these criminal encounters after criminal encounter, no one stopped this guy until it was way too late. And it's wild that it was allowed to escalate to how it escalated. So at this point, Petiot had purchased several properties actually in and around Paris. So, and at the time, he was actually making these house purchases like in his son's name, like fraudulently in his son's name. So most notably, he purchased 21 Rue Le Cerf, which is, that is the notorious house in which most of the victims were found. It's a very notorious property. This home was a very nice home. It was actually one of the more extravagant homes that he had. He tended to live very frugally and in tiny apartments with, you know, no car, and he would walk or bike everywhere. And he was a guy that didn't like to spend a lot of money. But this,
for a guy who liked money, what did you do with it? Because you didn't spend it, I guess.
Wanted to look at it, put it in a bathtub, and roll around in it, like all of us do with our money.
You wanted to consume it.
Do you guys not do that?
Lay it on.
So this house at 21 Rue Le Cerf, this notorious house, again, very nice home. It sort of had like columns or pillars in the front. And behind it, there was a courtyard that was like his house and a couple other properties. But it was like this nice manicured courtyard. There was a garage like for the inner city. And this was actually very close to L'Arc de Triomphe. So, I mean, it was like dead center in the middle of Paris. So, I mean, for being in the middle there, it was a very big, luxurious home. So, 1942.
So, you've probably been near it.
Yeah. I walked right by it because I walked through the L'Arc de Triomphe when I went there. So, 1942. The narcotics dealings are starting to catch up with him, and he is still doing this on the side, sort of in a limited capacity to make some more money. So what he's doing essentially is like taking these large quantities of narcotics and selling them for people to sell on the street or selling them directly to drug users. And enough people started coming forward with concerns that people were dying after simple procedures, and that two people in particular that he sold narcotics to were actually informants for the authorities. So he was caught red-handed with that. There was no denying that he was actually doing that. So his medical license is temporarily suspended. Finally, somebody does something with this guy's medical license. And he was issued a hefty fine. This did go to trial, and it was discovered that the two informants who were set to testify against him had mysteriously vanished.
Stop it.
It's ridiculous.
Stop it.
Mysteriously vanished without a trace.
Come on.
Even without their testimonies, though, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to a brief period in prison and even more fines. It was like days in prison.
Were they ever found?
We'll talk about it. Yeah. For a moment, let's mention the geopolitical climate.
Let's do that.
So we are on the cusp now of World War II. This is the early 1940s. Nazism is on the rise, and Germany had just defeated France. France! Did you look? And now the Nazis have essentially taken over France. And German-occupied France was not an awesome place to be around this time. So with the occupation, it made life really complicated for the French citizens that were existing. There were shortages of food, clothes, shoes, other necessities.
I should, for anyone that loves to read, a book by Kristen Hannah, I should give you the book. The Nightingale takes place in France during World War II.
Really?
And it is one of the best books I've ever read.
Interesting. So if you want to know more about what it was like back then, that's a good...
The Nightingale. It will kind of give you the background to this whole time frame. It talks about the different parts of France that were occupied, not occupied.
I see.
Anyway, one of the best books I've ever read.
I will link it in the show notes.
Oh, you should.
Yes, I will. Absolutely. So, you know, there's these shortages that citizens are dealing with all of a sudden. There's these mandatory curfews in effect for all citizens. No one's allowed to be out. There's German soldiers just like
everywhere,
walking around with weapons.
They also got housed in people's homes. That's part of like what's in this book is having some of the soldiers live in the home with you.
Wow.
Your husband's been taken off to fight in the war, but we're going to stay. And live in your house.
That is wild.
Make you cook us food. You're rationing.
Yep.
But you have to cook this meal.
Oh, wow.
For this German soldier.
Thank you for mentioning that, Devin.
It really is one of the best books I've ever read.
Time to have to live. Isn't that wild? So, failing to adhere to any of these strict rules imposed by the Nazis that were there could mean imprisonment. It could even mean death. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people were essentially living in fear and having to ration everything. I mean, it was just a miserable
time. And these are people that were not being scrutinized by the Nazis.
Right.
You know, they weren't fitting into any of those stigmas that they were putting in. Jewish,
no.
African-American,
they
all
were
of those
just trying
different...
to exist. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But the persecution from the Nazis for those groups was so insanely real.
Yes.
The Nazis start imposing rations too, like formal rations on things like food and clothes, like you mentioned. And so people are living on very, very little and literally are given just enough to like sort of make it to the next day. And then the next day, Germans had occupied certain parts of France. They had occupied Paris at the time, and they had been even dropping bombs on a few major cities in the area throughout Europe also. During their assaults, but had decided to spare Paris because it was sort of a symbol of France. Mm-hmm. So they, at the time, did not decide to do anything like that to Paris. Now, he's released after this latest, you know, minor-ish legal entanglement. And this was a bit of a turning point for him. This coupled with, you know, the changes in the climate and all of a sudden they're occupied by Nazis at the time. He seems to be done pretending to be the good guy at this moment. He continues to be super shady in general. And after the 1940s defeat of France by Germany, Germany really started imposing forced labor and were drafting French citizens to go fight on the German side or even just do labor over like manufacturing labor. And other sorts of labor. And so citizens are being drafted left and right. Of course, this includes Petio, who promptly falsifies medical disability documents, which exclude him from the draft.
Shocker.
Yeah, shocker. Of course he's getting out of that somehow. He doesn't want to go back to...
He didn't want to shoot himself in the other foot.
No, he didn't want to have to shoot himself in the foot again. That would be a bummer. So this gave him a brilliant idea. I could do this for other people.
Oh, great.
I could charge a fee, and I could just give a bunch of people medical
fake
disability
documents.
Paperwork. I have the letters behind my name, technically. He did that, too. As we know, Petio is very much into politics, and he's a bit of an extremist. Like, he's extreme on one side. And he becomes very active in the resistance, the French resistance. So he is like, liberate Paris, fuck the Nazis, which I don't disagree.
Right.
He started you know, establishing himself with a big group of other resistors. And one of his roles early on in this group was to start gathering information. And people that were sick or injured that had been drafted and then returned after being injured and got treated by Petio, he would like question them, essentially. So a patient would come in because he had, you know, been shot in the shoulder and he was released from the draft and sent back to Paris. And he would say, well, what was it like? What was the housing like? What did they do to you guys? And he would be gathering all this information, reporting it back to his extremist group, the resistance. So during his trials, like later on, he also boasted that around this time he started developing and inventing secret weapons. And he claimed, which this is totally unfounded and it sounds absolutely ludicrous, so I'd be very surprised if this was true, but he claimed to have developed a secret weapon that shot projectiles of some kind, but would deliver a lethal blow every time using a completely undetectable projectile and would leave no outward visible wounds or visible signs of injury. So he claimed to have tested this weapon on German soldiers that were just walking in the street. He would just like fire whatever weapon this was at the soldier, and the soldier would then like drop dead, and that people assumed that they all died of just medical events because they couldn't. Yeah. It's ludicrous. It doesn't make any physics.
There's got to be something there.
Well, there had to be. Again, right. I don't know that this is really true. It seems a little ridiculous.
Just a little bit.
So he made those claims, again, unfounded. He also claimed to have planted booby traps all over Paris for these soldiers. He also later claimed that he had really climbed the ranks within this group of resistors, and he was like bumping elbows with really high level people and commanders within the group. And it, again, really unclear if any of this was true, but he, you know, boasted that he was like a big deal within this group. Mm-hmm. This is where things start to take a little bit of a sinister turn. So we are going to get into one of Petio's most lucrative scams that he did. We know he loves the rush of petty crimes, but we suspect he's killed before for financial gain and for power. Mm-hmm. Petio starts using this war to his advantage. Now, during the German occupation of France, there's, you know, people in suppressed groups like Jews, primarily Jews, but you know, people from African descent, and handicapped people. I mean, there was just so many that right. were victimized. And he started, because they were all looking for safe passage, there were groups that were offering escape networks. Like they would try and extract these people who were running from the Nazis, like essentially trying to escape with their lives. And say, you know, pay us a fee and we will get you to Argentina or South America, somewhere in South America where you're far away from this bullshit. Mm-hmm. So people were starting to funnel these, like the resistance was starting to help funnel people out of the country. So Petio says, what if I start offering the same thing, but not actually? So he comes up with this code name. He goes by Dr. Eugene for this operation. Under this code name, he thinks up this scheme in which he would claim to have access to safe passage for people who wanted to escape the German regime and to offer them a safe way to leave the country. He said what he would advertise sort of on the down low, like on the underground, is that he had this whole network that was funneling these people wanted by the German government through, you know, to South America, essentially, and that you could pay a fee of 25,000 francs to get safely out of France and into Argentina or other countries in South America. And they would go through Portugal. There's a big shipping port there.
So I'm liking this idea, but I know he didn't do that. What did he do to them?
So there were, like I said, there were a bunch of these escape networks like already mm-hmm. established. So it was a thing. Like
that's part of like what's in the book yeah. that I mentioned.
Yeah.
So, but theirs was specifically for like British or American soldiers.
Oh, I see.
That like were downed in their jets or whatever in
gotcha.
France.
Okay.
And to help get them out of France. And I think they were going into Spain, I think.
I see.
But okay. So yes, these existed. And
yes.
I actually think they talk about the resistance in that novel that
I'm
I mentioned.
Sure they do.
Yeah.
And that's the resistance is offering a lot of these, you uh-huh. know, a lot of these escape networks. So he and some accomplices, and we'll talk about them in a second. These accomplices are mainly people he encountered through the Gestapo. So when you hear me say Gestapo, I'm talking about like the presence that Germany has within the country. And so he developed a scheme with some accomplices he encountered through the resistance. So there's like the resistance and then there's the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm.
Their names were Raoul Fourier, Edmond Pintard, and René Gustave Nézandé. Now, this last guy, Nézandé, was actually Petiot's oldest known friend. And the two went way back. Actually, Nézandé worked at the town hall in Villeneuve when Petiot was the mayor there. And that's sort of how they met. For whatever reason, Nézandé later on would say he was just like hypnotized by this guy's charisma and just like decided at one point that he's my best friend and I'm going to follow him anywhere. So he ended up making his way to Paris shortly after Petiot and his family moved there. So when he heard that Petiot had another plan to make more money, Nézandé was all too eager to jump on board with this. So he has this band of cooperators, essentially. Of course, the trouble with that was that there was no actual escape network. And what happens is that these three accomplices would go out and find people who were in hiding from the German government mm-hmm. or wanted for whatever reason. And they would entice them with promises that they could offer an escape route to South America and they could finally move on with their lives without fear of prosecution, blah, blah, blah. Again, mainly Jewish people just trying to, you know, not get killed. These people would be brought to Dr. Eugene for an examination to deem them medically fit. This was really Marcel Petiot. Marcel would be the one getting them prepped to go. He would have them pack themselves up to make sure they could really disappear without a trace. Once they paid their fee, he would be told that their transport's almost ready to leave. But first, you need this vaccine to inoculate you from the, you know, insect-borne illnesses that are in South America.
Okay.
Of course, people had no reason to, mm-hmm. you know, doubt that. Oh, thank you. You know, I appreciate you offering that as well. What they didn't know that what he was giving them was not a vaccine.
No shit.
It was cyanide.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. So I think we've touched on cyanide before. But we'll talk about it again just for the sake of this. So cyanide is a chemical that can be found in many different materials nowadays. Currently most common in like a household insecticide. It can be found in certain polishings, like metal polishings, industrial cleaners. And it's also present in like minute amounts in apple seeds and certain fruit pits, weirdly enough. Not nearly enough to like really harm you, but it's mm-hmm. present. It's there. Cyanide is incredibly dangerous when you're exposed to enough of it. And it can lead to like certainly lead to death. It can be absorbed orally, or it can even be, if you get it on your skin, you can absorb it that way too. So you have to be really careful just when you're handling it. So cyanide ions work by interfering with cellular respiration and oxygen. So essentially what happens is that, you know, our tissues obviously need those nutrients to live. So cyanide does its damage by causing widespread cell death that mimics hypoxia. So it essentially makes it so that your body cannot use the oxygen that you're breathing in, even though you're breathing. So you're essentially hypoxic systemically, mm-hmm. even though you're really not.
internally suffocating you.
Yes.
Essentially.
That's exactly what it is. And so there is actually a gas version called hydrogen cyanide as well. And poisoning from this is actually very common because it's present in smoke. Like it's common through smoke inhalation during house fires. So actually when somebody, you know, really does poorly due to smoke inhalation, it's because there's often a presence of hydrogen cyanide that prevents that gas exchange. So acute exposure can cause seizures, cardiac arrest, apnea in a matter of seconds to minutes, like very quickly. At lower doses, it can cause things like headaches, vertigo, confusion, all essentially, you know, signs of not perfusing your tissues. And after these initial signs, it would kind of progress to changes in vital signs like hypotension, tachycardia, all compensatory mechanisms to try and oxygenate your tissues. Treatment, if this is confirmed, is pretty limited. There's really no antidote. It's just systemic, like supportive care. So you can give 100% oxygen, support their vital signs, intubate them if you need to, and just kind of wait for it to pass, correct the electrolyte stuff, fix the kidneys. Like it's all just fallout from that. There's no removing it from your system. So cyanide was a pretty good choice for Petio because this, you know, he could give the injection and people would die very shortly after. So essentially, this person would drop dead while in his office and like almost instantly, like within minutes at the longest. So his accomplices knew full well what was going on and they all split the fees from
people. This makes him no better than a Nazi.
No, 100%.
This makes him a Nazi.
Yeah, 100% it did.
Than a Nazi.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's the people that are running from the Nazis feel that he's safe. He's giving them an out. At least with the Nazis, if you're in a concentration camp, you know what you're what's going to happen to you. You know you're either going to work yourself to death or you know that you're going to go to a gas chamber.
Exactly.
Right? With Petio, this is a route that's going to make
you're
me
safe. You're giving them hope.
I'm giving them money to get me out of here, to get me and my family out of here.
Exactly. And then they're realizing in these last moments that, something is very wrong.
Sure.
And
give
then
me
they
this
drop
vaccine
dead.
To make me safe when I get to South America.
Exactly. He's trying to make them feel like safe. I'm actually going to have a life. And then in those last few moments, like I said, take it all away. He and his accomplices are running this for like just under 2 years. And initially, Petio later admitted that he would dispose of bodies in the San River. So he would, just dump them in the river. And this started to make him a little nervous because he started fearing, constant flow of bodies is going to, someone's going to start finding body parts here pretty soon.
No
and then
kidding.
The jig's going to be up. So he felt that he needed a better way to really dispose of bodies and make them go away and dispose of the evidence as well. In this time, Marcel spends less time seeing patients. He does still see them from time to time, but he's doing medicine a little less.
I thought he was stripped.
So he had been stripped, but it was it was temporarily suspended. It wasn't stripped completely, and he got it back. It was reinstated. So he and his buddies named their operation Flytox. Okay. So it's not known for sure, but at the time, Flytox is also the name of a popular insecticide used during that time period. And it's thought that Petio maybe extracted his cyanide compounds from that insecticide, and that's why they called it that. But I don't know why they would pick that name otherwise. Now, this is where things start to sort of get into a little bit more graphic content, but I'm going to be as respectful as I can while still illustrating the gravity. And again, we're not going to get too heavily into the gore quite yet. So in March of 1944, neighbors of the notorious house at 21 Rue Le Sueur noticed a strong stench that had been progressively getting worse and had progressed to the point of becoming unbearable. His neighbors, who occupied 23 Rue Le Sueur right next door, had reported suspecting that, like, there must be a rotten animal. Like, it's just like baking in the sun and getting worse and worse and worse. But one of the neighbors was a war veteran, and on later interviews, he had stated that he immediately recognized the smell as rotting dead humans.
Decomposition.
Because during the war, he had spent 5 days trapped in a foxhole with several dead bodies.
Oh, no.
And so he said, I mean, one never forgets that
smell. Of course.
And it immediately brought me back. So he's like, this is not an animal. So he knew, he kind of suspected something was very wrong next door in these last few days. Additionally, the property was running a boiler, like a furnace, all the time. Round the clock, and it was like warm outside. Like, there's no reason for you to be burning wood all day and all night. And it was like not a clean burn, it was thick black smoke. There was ash covering everything, it was pouring constantly out of the smokestack, like enough that neighbors are like, what the fuck is he burning?
Like, well, now we know.
Even when it wasn't cold and it was unrelenting, it was smelly, it was strong, it was thick, and it just took over the whole little neighborhood. What ended up sort of triggering an investigation was that neighbors started noticing a strong gas or oil smell like around the property. And their fear was like, well, I mean, the stove is burning. If he has a gas leak, like, we're all gonna explode. Yeah, exactly. So, Marcel didn't call them. The neighbors called this in. They call the gas company. Can you please just go check out this house, 21 Rue Le Sueur? They're burning and burning and burning, you know, in their wood-burning furnace, and there's, like, a strong gas smell now. Can you figure that out? So, police soon receive a call from a technician at the gas company. Now, the owner of the home was not home. The guy let himself in because as soon as he got there, he smelled the gas as well. And he went immediately straight to the boiler. And he was quite sure that what he saw, he described as charred human remains inside the boiler. Mm. Now, the police were dispatched to the door initially, and they found a note on the door that said Petio was gone. The family had gone away, would be gone for about a month, and they had left a contact number and an address that they were at. So at this time, you know, smoke is still pouring from the chimney. Like, first of all, if you're gone, who the fuck is burning?
Right.
Pick up the phone. They call Petio and they said, hey, we're the police. You need to come home because there's something going on with your smokestack. It's pouring out smoke. And we just got a report that the gas guy went in and saw something real bad. Like, you need to get here now. So Petio says, okay, I'm leaving right now. I'll come home. Don't do anything. Don't go inside. I will be right there.
I repeat.
So police waited a short period, but flames start shooting up like out of the smokestack, and they're like, oh fuck, there's a chimney fire, and like there's that gas smell. So fire is dispatched to the house, and they're like, wait, we can't wait for this guy, we gotta go inside. So they bust inside, fire goes in, like, they have a ladder truck, they go in through the upper floor, and the police enter the property through the front door, and they make quite a grisly discovery at that point, which we will discuss in episode 3.
I was just going to say, brace yourselves, everyone. But I thought you were at least going to say what they saw.
No. I don't have that. Dude, an hour and 13 minutes already. There's just so much.
What the hell?
It doesn't stop with this guy.
Petio, the Nazi.
Petio. So anyway, sorry for the
another
like
cliffhanger.
Wicked. I know, I'm so sorry to do it to you guys, and this was like a really bad cliffhanger, but I promise.
And if there's 4, that means there's still one more cliffhanger to go.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Kate is like really keeping us on strings here.
I love you guys.
Hopefully for everybody else. Me, I'm sitting here like, what now?
I know.
If you want to keep listening to us, you can find us on Instagram by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can also tweet at us at Med Crimes PC.
You can find us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
Or if you wish to join our band of Patreons.
And get in, last chance for that Patreon giveaway that's coming up.
Do it. Don't think about it. Just do it.
Do it.
www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. Wow. I squashed together those W's, didn't I?
And if you want to be a part of our upcoming Big Room Banter, you can send in your stories to medcrimes@gmail.com.
We want stories, guys. Hurry.
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 Thanks for listening, everyone.
Mwah.